Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/GraveTalks80 and use code GraveTalks80 to get a total of $80 off your first month, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply. Please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. Today on The Grave Talks, a better understanding, a conversation with James Copert. As children, many of us have imaginary friends. Friends that we can't see, but we pretend to be there. What happens when a child is, in fact, seeing these friends? Learning their names, likes, interests, and history. Only for these facts to match up with a real-life child who passed on many years before. James Copert is a man who had very real imaginary friends. This would lead to an upbringing where he would meet other spirits who would be anything but friends, leading others to believe his family was cursed and heartbreak beyond belief.
I've been involved with the paranormal since before I can even remember. So as a child, my parents would find me talking to people with kind of old English names that I hadn't heard before. So kind of I'd be sat talking to Gertrude, or I'd go in someone else's house and I'd talk to some other old English name, and there weren't things that I'd kind of come across before, and used to freak my parents out. And then I even named my child after one of my friends when I was little, called Aggie, who used to get up to mischief with me and used to play and have conversations in the first house I lived in. But it really kind of started one morning when I woke up and I saw a Roman legion soldier in my bedroom, just kind of stood. I definitely felt awake, and I kind of had the conversation at school and started being called Ghost Boy and bullied a little bit. But that was kind of, it sparked my interest from there. It didn't even scare me, that one. It was kind of, I remember the light coming in the window, and it was almost kind of an angelic form. It wasn't a scary thing, but it was fascinating that was in my bedroom. And I just kind of started reading things and becoming more kind of interested after that.
So you weren't scared by this event in your room, but you were fascinated and I guess comfortable enough to go into class and share with your schoolmates what happened. Did it register to you when you were sharing this with your schoolmates that this was an abnormal thing? This is something that maybe most of your friends have not experienced.
Yeah, definitely it did, because their response was to kind of shy away from me and shy away from the conversation and call me names. But I guess I'd kind of speak into what some people would term imaginary friends from a young age. Mm-hmm. And just being kind of often seeing slightly different things. I've always been different anyway. So I was diagnosed with acute ADHD as a child. So I was already extremely hyperactive and kind of different anyway. So even getting a different response from people.
Sure.
I even can remember thinking, I've got memories, whether they're true or not, of even being able to levitate at a young age, as bizarre as that sounds. I still don't know whether that's childhood fantasy or mm-hmm. it actually happened, but that was kind of at the age of about 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. So just strange things have often occurred around me.
So when you had that first experience there with the Roman soldier that was in your bedroom as a child, I know you told your friends about it. Did you tell your parents?
I did, yeah, and they kind of were just, well, that's just James, you know, that they have always been used, as I say, since I could first talk. I was talking to invisible people,
yeah.
Interacting, even could say where they were and what their names were. So they were kind of used to it by then.
Were they thinking that there's something paranormal going on with our son, or did they think that you just have an overactive imagination, as a lot of parents would?
I think from my family history, so on kind of both sides of the family, there's been some sort of links to the paranormal. So on my Dutch side of the family, my auntie has healing hands. My grandmother, before she died, she begged. She was in a concentration camp. She was part of the Dutch resistance, and she was fearful, because all her brothers and sisters had been killed, that she was going to also die, and she said she prayed to for her parents to ensure that she was going to survive for them. And she said that the room lit up and that someone walked in and told her that she was going to be liberated in 2 days, which she was. And even on my grandparents in my English side, we both had kind of paranormal experiences. Both my parents have as well throughout. So they used to own a pub in Twickenham, which is where I first lived near London. And that was they had some mediums that kind of worked and had to leave because that was too much of a corridor, they said. So they've always had lots of kind of involvement anyway. So I won't say they were into it or really interested in it, but it was always kind of, it wasn't abnormal in their world. Let's put it that way.
Sure. How far did the curiosity about the Roman soldier take you in terms of trying to figure out why a Roman soldier, why in your bedroom, who was he? I mean, did you ever go down that road?
Yeah, more recently, really. Just kind of recalling that was my first full spirit I saw kind of directly. Mm-hmm. Well, that I can remember. And I did a bit of research into Finham in Coventry, which is the area it was. And there was a Roman fort nearby. And looking on the map, they had different outposts. So potentially this was a residual energy of, he didn't interact with me or anything. He was literally stood there. And it was like potentially a residual energy of maybe a lookout post, which one was situated within Finham. So chances are that could have potentially been where my bedroom was.
That's very interesting. When you had this experience, or you had that experience, was it followed up by other experiences? I know you said you had other childhood imaginary friends as well that yeah. That you end up even naming your daughter after, which I think is really cool. Tell me about those other children. Tell me about those other playmates you had as a child that, looking back on you, realized they were ghosts.
Yeah, so Aggie was in our house, and I used to talk to her all the time. We used to play hide and seek, and I'd be waiting, hiding behind the curtains, and wait, you know, till I was found. And my parents used to watch this with kind of keen interest. So we often played hide and seek together, but it was only in the house. So Aggie didn't come out anywhere else with me. I'm told it was only just in that house alone. And if I went somewhere else, in say in another house, it wouldn't always happen. Some houses would be none, but I'd go in a different house and start talking to someone else in that house. So, but Aggie was kind of my friend until we moved into from Walsgrave to Finham, and then very much just Aggie had disappeared. So she was only in that house. So kind of at the time, she was just a friend. So I must have imagined her just being a real person and speaking to her as an actual playmate. But my parents said they didn't see her, although things sometimes moved, which has been kind of a feature, especially as I hit puberty, where things started moving around quite a lot.
So while you were having this playmate, Aggie, in your mind, was this registering to you as this is another child just as real as someone that you went to school with? Or did you know to yourself, since your parents didn't see her, were you aware that they did not see her? Did you know that she was a ghost? What was her, basically identity as a ghost or a human to you as a child?
So from what I can remember, because I was really young, I did remember that my parents didn't see her, but it's what's normal every single day to day-to-day life. So, you know, for someone that's living with abuse, I guess that's just normal to their life. And it's only when they move into a different life do they not recognize that. So for me, that was just, it was completely normal.
Sure.
And I guess I would have expected that every other child had this playmate that kind of just suddenly appeared and mm-hmm. disappeared at will whenever they wanted to. So for me, it was just very normal. It's only kind of when you get older and have more kind of self-realization that you do know that it's was something abnormal, I guess.
When you look back on your playing with Aggie, I would think there may be like specifics to it as far as how she looked. Obviously, you know, the names tell a story in itself of them being of a different generation. But did she dress? Was there features of her that maybe way that she talked to you or interacted with you that made her look or feel like she was from a different place and time, especially looking back on it as an adult, understanding those perspectives better?
Yeah, it was more the fact that she'd just appear and disappear kind of whenever she wanted to. So I'd be playing and then she'd suddenly be stood in the room. And then I couldn't find her in the house because she just vanished. And it was kind of those type of things. I don't really, you know, looking back, I would have done, but at that time, that was just what she wore. Mm-hmm. So to me as a child, she was just Aggie, just my playmate, rather than noting specifically what she was kind of wearing or anything. Mm-hmm. That really didn't register at that age.
About how old were you when you were playing with Aggie?
I was probably about 5 or 6, okay. That, you know, so just kind of starting primary school.
Okay. I'm curious, as you've gotten older too, have you ever done any research into trying to find the origin stories of Aggie as well, or come across anything?
It's been difficult. So we moved out the area. So I started off in London, then we moved to Coventry, and then we've moved kind of up north. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall the addresses. My parents can't remember either, like the specific addresses. So it's pretty hard to kind of track down the history. It would be interesting to find out, but I can't honestly remember the addresses we lived at.
Wow. My question, I guess, would be, if you were able to go back to that house as an adult, yeah. do you think Aggie is still there?
Yeah, I guess if I could go back, I'd love to go back. I'd love to be able to see if I could communicate and find out a story and everything. It'd be interesting to see if she remembered me as well.
It would be. It'd be interesting. I mean, obviously, you have to put into question, and I think the answer in this case would very likely be, you know, did she age with you? But if she was from a different generation, you would almost have to assume she's, you know, permanently a little girl, you know, on the other side. So you show up, you're now an adult, and then here's your childhood playmate. Yeah. Still a child, you know, it would just be very interesting. When was it for you that you had the realization that little girl that was your childhood playmate was in fact a ghost?
I think it was when I was older, because we just kind of moved house, and mm-hmm. and then she was gone, and I do remember missing her, and there wasn't anything in the next house, so mm-hmm. I didn't have a kind of new playmate, and my brothers had come along by then as well. So it was just, it was there in the past, and my parents used to tell me stories about the things we used to get up to. So there wasn't that kind of realization. There was a point where I kind of grew older and noticed that she was something different. They just kind of, I moved house and she stayed behind at that house.
And that was it. Was there ever like a goodbye or anything? Was there ever a message like, oh, you know, I'll maybe see you later or anything like that?
Yeah, I remember being really upset when we were moving. I remember that really kind
Did
of distinctly.
And
I think I remember, obviously I was young, but I do remember a conversation of being sat in my bedroom and just saying, I've got to go now and bye-bye, and asking her if she was going to come, and just remembering that she wasn't, and that was going to be the last time I was going to play with her.
That's interesting. Back to our conversation in just a moment. First, I need to thank our supporter today, HelloFresh, where you guys, you're going to love this. You can get yourself $80 off your first month, including free shipping on your first box. I'll tell you how to do that in just a moment. First off, what is HelloFresh? It is the meal kit delivery service that I absolutely love. You get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouthwatering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. With HelloFresh, it's America's number one meal kit for a reason. HelloFresh lets you skip those trips to the grocery store and makes home cooking easy, fun, and super affordable. I love their recipe cards because you can just look at the pictures and go, okay, I get it. You know, sometimes you read a recipe, you're like, huh? No, they make it so, so easy. If you're not like a master cook in the kitchen or even just an average cook in the kitchen, if you don't ever really cook, HelloFresh can help you do that. You're going to save time, money, and stress effortlessly. It's convenient because it comes right to your doorstep for easy home cooking with the family. No wandering around the grocery store or trying to put your mask on in the grocery store or playing, I call it Pac-Man from Hell. In the grocery store. It is, because I feel I'm wearing a mask when I go around the grocery store, and then sometimes you have people who aren't, and it's like Pac-Man from Hell. You're like running away from the ghosts, if you will. Anyway, this stuff comes right to your door, so no more Pac-Man from Hell in the grocery store. The recipes are easy to follow, quick to make, with simple steps and pictures to guide you along the way. HelloFresh cuts out all that stressful meal planning and grocery store trips. It just comes right to you. You can cook dinner for your family in about 30 minutes or even less. Plus, you can save about 40% by using HelloFresh versus shopping at your local grocery store. Plus, it's more convenient. There's so many good things about HelloFresh. Delicious, nutritious. You get a variety of things. You can choose your delivery options. You can choose your meal options. You can choose your dietary options. Over 90% of the ingredients are sourced directly from growers to ensure the freshest recipes delivered right to your door. It is so flexible for your lifestyle, so you keep your fridge stocked by adding extra proteins or sides like garlic bread on a weekly basis, whatever you need. There's so many ways to customize this to your life. I think you should try it out for yourself, and here's a great reason why. You can get yourself $80 off your first month. Go to HelloFresh.com/GraveTalks80. Use code GraveTalks80 to get a total of $80 off your first month, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply. Please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. That's HelloFresh.com/GraveTalks80. Use code GraveTalks80 to get a total of $80 off your first month, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply. Visit HelloFresh.com for more details.
I have an interesting brief story I can relate here that I want to continue on to what happened as you moved. My wife, who co-hosts our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online, she actually had a realization very similar to that on the air, live when we were very early in our podcast about 7-8 years ago. We were talking about imaginary friends, and she had brought up her imaginary friend, and right. And she started describing what this person looked like in great detail. And then she asked me if I had had one. And I said, honey, you do realize most people do not physically see their imaginary friend. It's not a, I'm really talking to somebody, they're pretending that they're, and it's yeah, just, yeah. For a lot of us, it's just that. It's just, let's pretend there's somebody there, but we're not truly seeing it at all. And she's, what do you mean you didn't see your imaginary friend? She just kind of went through life thinking, that's what you do, because this, you know, yeah. It's an odd conversation to have anyhow an adult. Yeah. So it's not exactly like, oh, this came up in conversation over dinner, you know. So it's, on the show, and it was weird, and for her and for me too, just because we kind of had this. So we dug deeper into, well, what did he look like? And she's like, I always thought it was odd because he dressed in turn of the century type clothing, and did speak in a very kind of different English than what, you know, she was used to in Texas at the time, in the early 90s and or late 80s, and then we did a little more research, or she did a little more research, and it turned out that there had been a horrible school explosion, one of the worst disasters in American history in terms of children losing their lives in a school disaster, that happened very, very close to where she was growing up in Texas. But this disaster occurred in the 19-teens. And hundreds of children had died. They actually even eventually to move the bodies because they did not have enough places to put them around where this the school had exploded. They were carted via train track to neighboring towns, and she happened to live in one of the neighboring towns, which is only a few miles from where this happened. But this train track is in her backyard, where she grew up. And we were just looking at pictures, and we've gone through the pictures of the victims before, and there's been at least one I know that she's looked at and said, I think this might be him. That she had been playing with. So you're not alone in this world of having the childhood playmate that you think is real and is very real to you. Then later in life you look at it and go, wait a second. I think there's probably more folks out there than we realize that probably have had that sort of experience, but just have never really discussed it. Number one, because they'll be looked at like they're crazy, and if they connect those dots. But for the rest of us who've been in that world, you know, it's just so fascinating and interesting. I know you said at around the age of 10, you had moved again into a very medieval type style home. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we moved. My mum was into horses and things like that, so we moved kind of up north so she could have her own land to keep some horses on rather than renting it. And we used to come on holiday in Scarborough, which is near York in the north of England. and we moved to this place called Brompton. So it was a medieval stone house. And also on this land was a patch of grass that was slightly different colour. And we used to get archaeologists come with metal detectors and used to pull up Roman coins. And they think there was a Roman villa on that land as well. So it's pretty ancient and been kind of lived in for a long, long time. And we were really excited because when we lived in the city, we were just in a little kind of small clothes that we couldn't come out of, and then here we had trees and fields and rivers to play in and everything. So as like young boys, we were really excited, but it turned out to be quite a dark place, really, with a lot of negativity that kind of attached to it due to what went on in that house.
Tell me more about what sort of history the house held.
So when the best place to start, really, was where my parents, I always tell this story where my mum asked me to go and grab her coffee mug out of her bedroom, and I refused to do it. And we'd only been moved in a couple of weeks, and my mum couldn't understand why I wouldn't go. And I just said, no, no. And they kept pressing me, and I said, no, because I won't say his name for the family. But I said the Mr. whatever his name was had killed himself in that room. And I remember they were really cross because they wanted to know who told me. And even despite kind of knowing my previous history, they didn't believe at first that I just knew that. They kept questioning me, and it was only when I said, look, I haven't even spoken to anyone that from around here yet, that they kind of accepted, and I knew that. So he'd kind of taken his life in that house, which is why my parents got it kind of at a cheaper price. And recently, from discussing things with my mum, the person that owned the house before that took his life as well, and that's been then a history which kind of leaked into my family within that house. So
walk me through what it was like when you first set foot into that new house. I mean, a lot of times getting into a new house is a happy occasion. There's some missing of where you came from, but sometimes it's like, ooh, this is new, this is exciting, this is, you know, bigger, better, that sort of a thing. What was it for you and your family as you walked through those doors?
So it was a really exciting thing at first. We'd come from an inner city house to the place where we used to go on holiday, so it was almost like a dream. With some fields for my mum to keep her horses. They were going to set up a business. We'd kind of really gone. It was a real exciting, a really expensive house that they got for a good price that was normally out of the price range for my family. And it was just a really exciting time for us all. We were really looking forward to it. But there was just that room. Now, what was really strange in the house as well, it was kind of two cottages put together into one. And where my parents' bedroom was, it was the end of a corridor. And there was another room beyond that, which we never even saw. It was completely walled off. I still don't know what was in that room. It's been converted since. But at that time, there was a kind of another bedroom just completely shut off from the rest of the house, completely walled with no window, door or anything into it. And the house was okay. It was quite quiet at first, but it was just that corridor. I used to look and just feel dread at the end of that corridor.
I want to ask more, and I want you to keep talking, but I want to stop on that point for a second. With a quarter of the upstairs completely walled off, the first thing I'd be doing as a homeowner is finding a way into that, whether that means breaking a wall down or whatever it is. What were your parents thinking about with that area? Did they just not care? Like, whatever, we have enough to worry about with getting the rest of the house up and running. I get that. Or were they too somewhat hesitant? What was going through their mind knowing there's a quarter of the upstairs that we're not touching and we can't seem to get to? What are they saying about that?
It's really strange, actually, because the whole downstairs and below that room, they had like a giant kind of living room that they kind of kept boxes packed. And we lived there for maybe 10 plus years, and they never unpacked a lot of the stuff. So it's almost like they were never psychologically settled, whether they consciously knew that or not. Yeah. They never kind of even physically unpacked. They had issues with the roof that needed doing. So that was kind of the major military investment. Mm-hmm. But things just started, I guess they did plan to eventually kind of knock it through and do to it, but things just started going downhill really quickly, even to the point where people used to talk about my family and say it was cursed, just because there was so much negativity as soon as we moved in that house.
How did the negativity start?
It started off with things such as, it started off with kind of paranormal activity, really. So, especially around me, as soon as I hit puberty, with things just kind of moving around. So I'd be just playing in my room and something would just kind of fly across the room. And I would even, you know, and at first I was like, am I hallucinating? But then other people would start seeing it as well. So other people would be with me, and certain people, things that it'd amp up even more. So my friend Matthew, who also kind of works these type of things, when he was there, things really used to amp up. So at one time, two things flew across the room at once, and I had a foosball table, and the balls just started rolling up and down. And that was kind of just a normal occurrence. But lots of kind of, my parents completely changed, where my dad kind of escaped, you know, to carry on the whole suicide theme. My dad basically told me, when I spoke to him about the history of the house, he said that if he did not leave that house, he would have killed himself. And those were his words. He just felt he had to leave. And he moved to the States in the end. And when I kind of met up with him, he was a completely different person than the person I knew in that house, who was quite a very depressed, angry, you know, aggressive man, which just is not him at all. He's like a proper California now, just really chilled back, really kind of happy-go-lucky sort of guy, but a completely different person when he was in that house. And my mum the same. My mum, I was talking to her last week about this, and I remember coming in one day, and the kitchen was just covered in blood. And my mum was on the floor, and she tried slitting her wrists. And that was just one of many occasions that she tried to end her life. And she doesn't remember it at all. I mean, there were genuine attempts as well. It wasn't a cry for help. There were genuine attempts. Mm-hmm. And she just doesn't even remember any of it. She was really shocked when I told her. And carrying on the kind of that history, my brother, although he'd left the home by then, he took his own life. And I remember being a small child in that house and attempting to strangle myself. And I was only a little kid. I was only maybe 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And that's how it just kind of made you feel. And
I don't want to touch on any sort of trauma that's going to be difficult to talk about. So, you know, share it at your own will. But I'm curious about things like this when there's someone who's in a house or a family that's in a house that feels this onslaught of depression and whatever else, you know, may be coming at you. Was there anything else going on in your lives or anything else that had changed that would in any way make your family kind of as a unit, you know, come down or suddenly have this veil put over you of depression? I mean, it sounds like initially you're going into this happy environment. There's places for the horses. It's what you've always wanted. It's the vacation home. It's where you go on holiday. But this is now going to be home. What is there anything you can point at and go, well, maybe that was attributable to, other than the change in your house?
There was just really bad luck within the place. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to set up this business, but it completely failed. So there was no money.
Okay.
We really struggled with money. My parents, like I said, they completely changed though initially. So I remember when my father moved out, I found it very difficult to go to sleep because there wasn't a violent, aggressive argument downstairs going on. And the silence was really hard to go to sleep to. So that was kind of the symphony that we used to fall asleep to just on a regular occurrence.
Yeah.
But just lots of kind of really bad kind of things happened. My mum ended up, how we lost the house in the end was my mum had an accident where she didn't even get taken to the right hospital because they didn't think she would survive after a horse kind of rolled on top of her head. And she was in a coma. And while we were in the coma, the kind of bank repossessed the house because there were no payments. It was just a continuously negative thing. But as I say, I've got ADHD, so I were having kind of behavioral issues. My middle brother, Lawrence, the one who ended up taking his life, was having major behavioral issues as well. And kind of my youngest brother, Oliver, he's kind of he had real depression for many years, kind of leaving this house as well. And it was only after a couple of years leaving the home he kind of picked himself up and doing really well. So it was just a very negative theme, but there was a darkness in there. There was a real darkness that was definitely supernatural that kind of belonged to that.
Tell me about some of the incidents. I understand how you were all feeling emotionally, but tell me some of the dark things, some of the events that occurred that kind of pushed you guys into those, you know, those dark corners where attempts would be made on people's lives, and how did you all get there? What was life like day to day in this house? What were some of the incidents?
It was just the constant. We were kind of left to our own devices, really. My parents seemed like they couldn't cope. My mum was outside with the animals, and my dad was just hidden away in one of the outbuildings on a computer, just to kind of hide him from everything. Mm-hmm. And then if we did anything wrong, it would be quite a nasty, aggressive response to that. It was just dark, and the house was kind of getting, I remember we couldn't afford heating, so it's quite cold, and mm-hmm. the windows would break and we couldn't afford to replace them. Everything just seemed to go wrong that could. And like I said, people genuinely actually thought we were cursed. The just amount of bad luck that would happen. If it was going to go wrong, it would go wrong. You know, and it was definitely kind of linked to that. I know there's some cultures on some islands that with a house made out of stone, they only allow one generation of family move into there because they believe the stones kind of hold the energy. So once they've been used, they abandon the homes and find new stone and quarry new stone to do it. And you know, that was a stone house, and it just really did hold things that we even began to see them eventually, some of these kind of negative kind of spirits.
That's very interesting, of the stone house tradition. You know, we think of that somewhat here in the States. Obviously, you know, the properties and the structures where you are date back much further than what we have here in the States. An old house here would be considered, you know, 1910. That'd be, yeah. Oh, wow, old. You know, we have nothing medieval. We have nothing, you know, where we say, hey, look how old that is. But we do talk about that, though, here with especially limestone homes, kind of turn of the century type things, as being likely more haunted, or stone structures being likely more haunted. And I wonder if that goes back to that tradition, or it's just simply the truth. It is what it is. It's not necessarily tradition. It's just a belief system, and there's a reason for that belief system. When you were in the house, tell me about your childhood. Tell me about, you know, how it kind of went and some of the experiences that you had in the home, from, you know, day one to the point of where and how you eventually left the home.
Yeah, so at first it was, there was a little village school, and, you know, we were the outsiders. We had southern accents as well, so we were just very different. And kind of day to day, my parents were just really busy, and we were kind of left to our own devices a lot of the time. And we just didn't like being in the home, so we spent most of the times just riding about on our bikes and being in the village, playing up trees, in rivers, and those kind of points were quite happy. But things in the home were just never, you know, we'd prefer to be outside if we could. Things were quite scary in the house. So from the kind of nice, playful kind of entities, spirits I was playing with when I was younger, it was decidedly different in this house. It just was really nasty. Like the first things that started occurring were, you'd be downstairs and then you'd hear kind of someone running upstairs, and you'd be shouting hello, hello, and there was absolutely no one there. And the strange thing was as well, it was running as if they were running through walls, so it's like someone sprinting but really loud on the floor. And then you'd hear, like, they'd be silent and then a door slam, and it those kind of things, which were just, it was almost there to purposely upset you, because if you were on your own, you could guarantee that would happen. Mm-hmm. Whereas with you, with other people, you kind of felt a bit safer. And it was almost that purposeful intimidation. It wasn't like a playful, kind of jokey, poltergeisty spirit that you often get. This was just really quite nasty. My parents just say, oh, there'll be mice under the floorboards, but mice don't bang on the floor. They like have little scurry and scratchings. This was really loud.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with James Copert about a better understanding. In part two of our conversation, we're going to ask, what was James' childhood like day to day in this house? And how did it feel when he finally left? Did paranormal things follow James out of this house when he'd go play at friends' homes? What does James view as the link between the paranormal and non-neurotypical people? What happened when James returned to this haunted house as an adult with his son? And does James feel any fear or hesitation about returning to investigate the house that he grew up in? All of that and more in part two of our conversation. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. You can sign up to do so at thegravetalks.com and click Become a Gravekeeper or directly through Patreon at patreon.com/thegravetalks. For $5 a month, you'll have access to all of our ghost stories, every single one of them, all of our interviews, part one and part two, hundreds of them to binge away on. And importantly, you'll be supporting this programming and allowing it to stay on the air and continue on. Be sure to support it at patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.